This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, April 26, 2024. I'm Caleb Brown. Just what kind of immunity should presidents have for acts they take while president, even acts that are clearly criminal in any other context? That's part of what the Supreme Court will consider following yesterday's oral argument where Donald Trump's lawyers argued that immunity from prosecution for former presidents should be extremely broad. Cato's Clark Neely discusses the case and how the high court might weigh Trump's various pending criminal charges. Clark, to the best of your ability, what were Trump's lawyers arguing before the U.S. Supreme Court?
I think the most charitable take on their argument is that, of necessity, a president and former president must have at least some immunity from criminal prosecution for at least some of the decisions and actions that they undertook while they were president. That's not a frivolous argument. You know, you think about the kinds of decisions that presidents make. Sauer, who's Trump's lawyer, used the following illustration in his intro. What about President Obama's decision to use drones to take out people abroad, including, in one case, somebody who was an American citizen? Do we really want presidents worried about potentially being prosecuted for murder after they leave office? That is not a frivolous question.
All right. So, but beyond that, Trump's lawyer was peppered with some questions, notably from Justice Sotomayor. What if the president decided that a political rival was, I don't know, dangerous or bad or something, and had them executed?
Yeah, exactly. And so that's where the action is in this case, right? Is trying to figure out what exactly is the scope of legitimate presidential immunity. And you can come up with any number of hypotheticals to try to test the outer bounds of this theory. And I think that's a good one. But then, of course, this case, the prosecution of Trump presents somewhat thorny questions because his argument is, look, I wasn't trying to steal an election. I was simply trying to exercise my constitutional right to raise concerns about the way in which the election was conducted, the votes were counted and certified, et cetera. And not only is that not a criminal act, but even if some of the things that I did may have been in kind of a gray area, I need immunity from that, just like any other president would need immunity. You know, both candidates in Bush v. Gore had issues with the way the election was conducted. Are they, you know, could they have been criminally prosecuted, et cetera? So as much as I want to sort of dismiss this case or characterize it as yet another unprincipled Trump effort to get out of responsibility for genuinely bad and indefensible conduct, there's more to this case, unfortunately, than I think a lot of us maybe would have conceded going into it. And the line drawing questions are challenging in the abstract, but I don't think they're going to prove to be difficult in this case. And I don't think that there are five justices who will sign on to the proposition that Trump should be immune from criminal prosecution from whatever he did on January 6th and the run-up to those efforts to frustrate the regular and lawful process of determining who the winner of the 2020 election was. He clearly has been alleged, at least, to have gone outside of any bounds of what could be sort of plausibly protected through any, you know, again, I would say principled application of immunity in this case. But as he so often does, he's essentially trying to, you know, suggest, well, what if I weren't such a crook? What if I, you know, had conducted myself in a way that was at least arguably sort of inside the bounds of what might be reasonable? What would we do then? I think the Supreme Court is going to say, well, you know, we'll figure that case out if and when it arises, but you don't fall in that category.
I was looking through the various newspapers' coverage of just his criminal and civil proceedings that are pending. And under the category of all the rest, the New York Times put stealing classified documents and threatening state election officials with jail time if they don't turn their state his way in the 2020 election. Those are things that have to weigh on the Supreme Court because those are pending cases about this guy.
You know, it's funny. I think that's right as a matter of human nature, but I'm not sure that it's technically sort of legally right. As I'm sure you're aware, and many of our listeners are aware, there are rules of evidence that prevent prosecutors from introducing, for example, evidence of other bad acts, prior crimes, for example. Because in our system, you're not supposed to be convicted of just being a generally bad person, and you're not even supposed to be convicted because the jury thinks you have a propensity for certain kinds of behavior because you've done it before. I think there are really sound policy reasons for not allowing fact finders and adjudicators to consider somebody's prior bad acts as a general matter, or, you know, essentially trying to say, well, you know, basically you're a crook, so probably you did this thing that's been charged specifically in this case. On the other hand, as I said a moment ago, I think there is a kind of an aspect of human nature that we know that there are some people who it's kind of reasonable to just call them a crook or a fraudster. And I think most of us, or many of us, feel that Trump is that kind of person, and that those kinds of people do have a propensity for breaking laws and defying norms. And ultimately, I think most people would be uncomfortable with the idea that Trump should just get a completely free pass, whatever it is he's been accused of doing, and that there needs to be at least some process by which, you know, the government can determine and put that question, for example, to a jury. Did he cross the line when he called the Georgia Secretary of State and asked him to find another 12,000 votes? And was he just asking, or was he threatening?
Right. And that's an open question that a jury in Georgia will have to determine, perhaps.
I think so. And I think they probably should. I mean, I've listened to that call. I hope everybody listens to that call. I think reasonable people can differ about whether Donald Trump crossed the line in the context of that call and whether he was making some kind of a veiled threat. I personally think he was. And if I were on the jury and, you know, it all came down to what I took from that call, which it probably wouldn't, but if it all came down to what I took from that call, I'd probably lean in favor of a conviction because I think he was threatening. He's not your next door neighbor. He's the president of the United States at the time he's making that call. And that carries a lot of weight. But anyway, I totally agree with your premise, which is this has to get sorted out somehow. Not all allegations merit criminal prosecution, certainly, and probably some alleged conduct should be shielded by at least some kind of immunity. Again, the easiest case would be a president's decision as commander in chief to order a specific use of military force abroad. We don't want to live in a world, I don't think most of us want to live in a world where a president has to worry about getting prosecuted for making that decision after they leave office. But neither do we want to live in a world where that basic insight becomes carte blanche so that no president can be criminally prosecuted for anything they do. You know, and even if a president commits treason while in office, we're limited to just impeaching and removing them from office. And the Senate can say, well, you can never run, you know, for office again. And that's the extent of our remedy and our response. I certainly don't want to live in that world. And I don't think that's the world that the Constitution envisions.
Are Trump's lawyers essentially, although obliquely, asking that essentially all of these criminal cases just go away?
I think that's a fair characterization of the implications of the argument that we heard yesterday, and that it may be that if pressed, Trump's lawyers would say, you know, look, if he were accused, you know, for example, of, I don't know, murdering a family member in the Oval Office in a fit of passion or fury, that would not be immune. But I kind of wonder if we'd get some pushback if it turned out it was a staffer, you know, because, well, you know, maybe disciplining staffers is within the sort of the office of the president. And even though he might have gone about it in a way that most people would disagree with, that's still arguably an official act as president. I mean, I'm being a little bit flippant here, but I do think that his lawyers are pressing a conception of presidential immunity that is well beyond anything that I think the Constitution plausibly provides, but equally important, or perhaps equally important, well beyond anything that is sort of a reasonable person who was open to the concerns that are very real here. Namely, we don't want presidents looking over their shoulder about every decision they make as president, that his lawyers are pushing well beyond what reasonable people would agree is, you know, fair to be concerned about. And they're really just making an argument that's trying to get their candidate who stands credibly accused of serious criminal acts, repeated criminal acts, off the hook across the board. So yes, I think that would be their ultimate argument, is that everything that's been charged so far in the four pending criminal cases against him, he's immune from, for the basic reason that they flow from his activities as president of the United States.
Was there anything notable in the questioning from the justices?
Well, yes, I think you know, I mean, look, the very fact that we're having the Supreme Court argument, this is the first time in the history of this country that a former president has been criminally prosecuted. That's notable. I would say that a lot of people are noting the fact that Justice Kavanaugh seemed much more receptive to at least some of Trump's arguments than most of the other justices. That may be in part due to his service. He was an assistant counsel to the president, so he has a lot of firsthand experience with some of these issues. It's not surprising that he might have that perspective. But, you know, I'd say the back and forth, I mean, there's something, you know, fundamentally unseemly, right, of essentially an argument in which it all comes down to, well, let's just say that my client did commit some crimes. We need to distinguish between the ones he gets a free pass from and the ones that he doesn't get a free pass from. That really was the essence of the argument. And I think there's something kind of fundamentally unseemly about that. But unfortunately, when you elect somebody to the presidency who has the character of a Donald Trump and the attitude of a Donald Trump, you will find yourself eventually having to answer a lot of unseemly questions, as we have been doing lately, and unfortunately, as we may be in for, depending on what happens 6 months from now.
How heavily should it weigh on justices? I know they're trying to create a sustainable system, right, of executive authority going forward, where the lines are as clear as they can be for the people who hold those offices. But, you know, how cognizant do you think they are or should be about the idea of, well, if we give this guy a free pass, what kind of candidates do we get down the road?
You bet. I do think there's a moral hazard here. I'm not sure how much the fear of criminal prosecution deters people like Donald Trump from seeking high office. Probably not all that much. But, you know, it's not a secret that at least some people who seek high office have a basic lack of character. George Santos, obviously, is a bad person. I think Senator Bob Menendez is pretty clearly a serial bribe taker and a corrupt senator. I'm not going to say that that's representative, but positions of power do tend to attract people who are interested in abusing that power and in some cases personally profiting from it. So I think it'd be foolish not to have that in mind to at least some extent. But the flip side of that coin, unfortunately, is that we really do live in a world where every single one of us could be plausibly, or almost every single one of us could be plausibly charged with having committed criminal act, probably within the last few months, if not days. And I would hazard a guess that nearly every senior executive branch official could plausibly be charged with serious criminal conduct for at least something that they've done in office. And that is a backdrop that, even if they don't fully articulate it, I think has to be on the mind of the justices when they grapple with these questions. And there was a really striking exchange at one point where Justice Alito said, in effect, to the Solicitor General's lawyer, Michael Dreeben, you know, in effect, like, yeah, you know, we've all worked in the Justice Department, and I'm sort of being, again, a little flippant here. It's not that they all have, but a disproportionate number of judges have. And, you know, we know that our colleagues were honorable people, but how much protection is the professionalism of a DOJ prosecutor or even a grand jury against a politically motivated prosecution? And I think the subtext, or at least I took the subtext to be not much protection. And that's, I think, a really valid and important concern. I am not going to say that I think the average DOJ prosecutor wakes up every day hoping to get the opportunity to initiate a, you know, dubious politically motivated prosecution. I don't believe that whatsoever. I think most of them are professionals trying to do their best to do an often difficult job. But we also have to not be blind about the temptations, the motivations, the kind of people who rise in an environment like that, the kind of political appointees who make the decision about whether to pursue certain people. There are already people who are openly talking about payback. And if all that's required is the ability of some prosecutor to sort of creatively string together some theory about how you committed a crime in office and you can be in the bullseye, well, guess what? I think that's coming. And so the justices, to the extent the nature of their questioning yesterday and their seeming willingness to go outside the four corners of the actual case in front of them, which is actually, I think, a pretty easy case. You know, does Trump have immunity for all of the things that he's been charged with in connection with January 6th? It's an easy answer. The answer is no. But the court was really interested, I think, more interested than in the average case, of thinking through the implications of not only their answer to that question, but their rationale. And I think they clearly have at least one eye on the effect of whatever rule they announce in this case on future administrations and the decision-making process of senior officials in those future administrations.
Clark Neely is Senior Vice President for Legal Studies at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast anywhere you like. And thank you for listening.